You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Savage Arms and the new shotgun from Savage, the Renegade. At the core of the Renegade is an industry-first patented dual-valve self-regulating gas system made to cycle higher power loads with the same reliable consistency as lower power target loads, all while cutting down on recoil. Now, the shotgun is ergonomic, it's well balanced, it has a patented stock pad that knocks down recoil, and definitely check out the information about the dual valve gas system that allows for this consistency, right? There is so many cool, creative things that Savage has done with this shotgun. If you want to learn more about the Renegade, visit savagearms.com/Renegade. Happy hump day, everybody, and welcome back to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I am your host, Dan Johnson, and I'm sitting in my office today, and I don't know if you can hear this, but I am eating baby carrots. That is my go-to snack when I feel like munching. So this is a shout-out to the baby carrot, because I'm a huge fan of eating baby carrots, and I'm also a huge fan of drinking Budweiser. So I wish you could see me right now. I'm drinking a Budweiser, and I'm eating a 2-pound bag of baby carrots. Now, I haven't eaten all 2 pounds today. It takes me about 2 or 3 days to eat 2 pounds of baby carrots. This is not what you guys were expecting, but I love baby carrots. I love Budweiser, and I love today's guest, Mr. Lucas Psycho. Man, he's been on several times, and if you don't know the guy, you need to know the guy, because he is as passionate about hunting and bow hunting and the outdoors and family as anyone I know. To be honest with you, I really look up to the guy, because I wish everybody could have the same passion that he does, the same drive that he does. And it's amazing. It's and as you will see in this podcast, or listen in this podcast, the way he talks, you can just feel the excitement in his voice. And that's why I like having this guy on. Today, we talk about, a lot of it has to do about the river bottom ground that he hunts. We talk about how him and his dad kind of got into bow hunting at the same time and learned how to hunt these river bottoms in North Dakota where he lives. We talk about the game-changing access education that he had, and that's basically from using the water to his advantage for access routes. We talk about high water, low water. We talk about strategy. We talk about a little bit about how him and his dad kind of had these learning experiences together. And then we end the show. You want to hear a guy get geeked out about something? His wife drew a moose tag this year, and he is jacked up. He's not even really thinking about whitetails right now, which is his bread and butter, his MO, what he gets passionate about. But his wife drew a coveted once-in-a-lifetime moose tag in North Dakota, and sounds like he's just going to be dedicating a lot of time to helping his wife fill that tag. So today we got to do a commercial, and today's commercial, which is fitting for this podcast, is Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands, the ultimate run and gun tree stand, made in America, so it's very high quality. If you are looking for a tree stand to get you into that world of being mobile, to get you into that world of really being able to tear down, set up, move, be mobile, go to the deer and not have to necessarily wait for them, Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands is definitely the product that you guys need to check out. Let me pull up the website here real quick. LoneWolfHuntingProducts.com. They have a couple different variations. They have the Assault, which is the smaller model. That's my preferred method. I run the Assault with four sticks, and they also have the Alpha, which is a little bit bigger of a platform. What you guys need to do is go visit lonewolfhuntingproducts.com, take a look at the sticks and stand options that they have, take a look at their Hunt Ready system. And I'm telling you right now, it is one of those products that will really change the way you hunt. It allows you to be efficient, allows you to be quieter. It allows you to get closer. And what all these things do is allow you to have more opportunities at target animals. So huge fan of Lone Wolf. Check them out, lonewolfhuntingproducts.com. And if you do decide to purchase, enter the discount code, tick-tock, 9FC50, and you will receive $50 off of all orders over $200. That's a pretty bitchin' discount, and they have flat rate shipping, so it's pretty easy to take care of. Lone Wolf, badass tree stands, and that's the commercial. Let's get into today's, man, it's kind of like a BS session, but there is a theme, and it's really about river bottom whitetails with Lucas Psycho, my man from North Dakota. In 3, 2, 1. All right. On the phone with me today, good buddy and passionate bow hunter, Mr. Lucas Psycho, man. What's up?
Oh, just surviving the pandemic, you know? It's like everybody else out there is trying to hang on, make it through this damn thing.
How has your life changed? How has your life changed?
Oh, well, I've been working from home for like, gosh, since I think it was the end of February, early March there, I think.
Yeah.
So I've been working from home, you know, which very fortunate, still got my job. You know, in that regard, working from home, it's taken almost, you know, in a weird way, it's gotten semi better for me as far as family life and stuff like that. Because you know, yeah. I get to be at home, be around the kids, and the wife and I, we had to take up homeschooling. You know, lucky for us though, right here, the school of Trenton, North Dakota, here, this public school our kids go to, they've done a fantastic job just getting everything lined up.
Yeah.
As far as getting classes online and all their meetings online and stuff like that, and all the schoolwork, getting it handed out and distributed and getting it back to them. Everything's been super easy, actually. So yeah. We lucked out because we've heard some horror stories from a lot of our friends.
I feel ya. Our teachers are all on point, man. They're sending videos and links, and they're having Zoom meetings, and they're doing a whole bunch of interactive things with the kids, which keeps them occupied, you know, a little bit throughout the day. And then the cool.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. For about an hour, right? An hour and a half.
Yeah. And then the rest of the day is let's just, you know, do kid stuff where we just terrorize and run wild and you know, doing what they do, you know, which is fine. My wife's probably taking on the most burden there because, you know, with me working from home too, I just barricade myself in our bedroom with my computer and everything like that. And then when I come out, I usually run out to the field and go run around and see my team and all that stuff that's out working in the field. So she's gotten the burden of having to do the whole homeschooling for the most part.
Yeah.
But try to chip in here and there.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I've learned is that I feel like my children are smarter than me at their age than I was. Like, I think right now I'm on the same level as my daughter. She's really smart, and she points out things that I don't, you know, that I don't catch. And she's like, "No, Dad, it's actually like this." And I'm just like, "Jesus, man, I'm making myself look bad."
And then, you know, and they're learning things way different. You know, it's way different learning styles these days than when we were in school.
Right.
So it's probably a good thing they don't get like only help from Dad, because Dad, right. Dad gets mad sometimes. Get mad, start acting like a caveman.
Well,
start banging stuff off the floor.
Right, throwing shoes.
Yeah, just throwing tantrums. Just can't get it, you know.
Well, the other day I took my kids out and I took them fishing at this local lake, and I taught them this like random things like, okay, check this out. All water flows downhill, right? If you put water, mm-hmm. if you put water here, it's going to go down here, and that's what creates rivers and streams, you know. And we caught a fish, and I'm just like, check the gills out. That's how they breathe underwater. And caught some bugs and identified some trees and some plants and things like that. So they got their biology lesson and their hydrodynamic lesson from dad. But I don't know how yeah. useful that would be. But the cool thing about the education that we could give them, if let's say the apocalypse hit, was how to hunt, and then they could eat, at least eat, right?
Right. Hunting, fishing, yep, that type of stuff, growing some food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you'll have to blow their minds and actually go, you know, there is a way that water does flow upward. And then children, that's called capillarity.
Yeah.
And I learned that from old Psycho on the podcast the other day. There's very few things that I know and I remember from school and in science class, but for some reason that capillarity thing always stuck in my head.
Okay.
You know, where water flows up in plants and all that stuff. So
I'm gonna
whenever
have to
I
look
throw that,
up.
That in there and try to make myself
right.
sound a little bit smarter than I am. You know, there it is. There you go.
There you go. All right. So when I reached out to you and I said, hey man, let's do a podcast. Of course you said, yeah, let's do it. I didn't really have anything lined up. Just wanted to kind of BS with you.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I don't know, I know we've talked about past specific bucks and how you hunted them and things like that. But one thing that I don't know if we've necessarily ever talked about was your introduction into actually hunting, you know, like what got you hooked and stuff like that. So I guess my first question to you mm-hmm. is who got you into hunting?
Well, my dad, he was only a rifle hunter up until I think I was probably around 10, 11, 12, I think. And he finally started to convert over to bow hunting only because, it was getting tougher and tougher to draw a rifle tag in North Dakota. And so that was kind of the traditionary thing, you know, growing up around here was a lot of deer drives and big groups of people, 20, 30, 40 different, 40 people in one group. And there'd be several groups running around in these river bottoms during opening of gun season every year. And that I, you know, to tell you the truth, you know, it might shock some people, but I mean, I miss those days, you know, the camaraderie of when everybody would be out there getting together and doing that. That was always a really fun time. And, you know, shit got wild sometimes. You know, there's some groups that are a little bit less ethical than others.
Yep.
So there'd be animals. I mean, the things that I heard of and I seen back then, it was like, oh my God, you couldn't do that today. 100%. You know, there too many people would be like, no, that ain't flying. But, you know, but more than anything, it was just that everybody, it was just a big deal. You know, school kids were just released from school on that Friday. Just like, yeah, if you're going hunting, just go ahead and take it off. It's excused. You know,
that's awesome.
And so we'd always do that. But over the years, it was getting tougher and tougher to draw the rifle tag. And so my dad was like, well, I'm not going to not hunt. And so I think he ended up getting a bow from somebody, or a friend of ours or something. I think he had an extra bow or wanted to get rid of one. And my dad picked it up and he started running around with it. And I think he kind of spent some time hunting, bow hunting without me. For I think it was almost a year or so, year or two maybe. And then finally I got curious enough, because he'd come home with these stories and be telling us about it, and he'd be all excited and jacked up about it. But he hadn't killed one. He hadn't killed anything with his bow. So finally one year he had allowed me to, you know, tag along. I think mainly I just didn't think I could go. And then I just asked him, I was like, hey, well, I want to go. Can I go and sit with you? And he was probably, for the most part, he probably held off and letting me go because, you know, bow hunting would be so tough from the ground. He wasn't hunting from a tree stand at that point. And having a, you know, a 10-year-old or so sitting there on the ground with you probably isn't the easiest way to kill a deer. You know, there's a lot of movement and too loud and all that stuff. So finally, I think he, he just let me come, and then realizing, oh gosh, yeah, you're cut out, you can make it, you know, and we had some good hunts, and finally he killed a deer. He killed a deer with me sitting right behind him, and I think ever since that first time seeing him draw back, and I kind of had the over the shoulder, the old over the shoulder angle of watching him draw back on the deer. I could see him and the deer. It was, you know, I was only a couple feet behind him, sitting on the ground, and watching that all unfold. I just thought from that moment on, like, this is what I want to do. This is the coolest thing I've ever seen. And so the following year, got a bow and killed my first deer with my bow that following fall, and was by far and away the best kill. I mean, it was I climbed up on somebody's old tree stand that had made out of wood, and we had been hunting this spot, me and my dad, just kind of teaming up on it. I'd sit an area and he'd sit another area, and we were after this one big buck in there. And I climbed up on these limbs. I was basically standing on a cottonwood limb with a little 2x4 and a crotch that was kind of the seat. And it was only about 11 feet, 12 feet off the ground. And a little fork horn came walking right below my feet, and I managed to stick him right through the neck. like I said, not the most ethical, not the best shot ever. But I'm being a new bow hunter, didn't even know what the hell I was really doing. And managed to kill the deer. I mean, he ran off, and he actually died really relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And it was just from that on, it was just, man, hooked, absolutely hooked. You know, and then just time and again, just being out there with him. And then my buddies, you know, a couple of my buddies started bow hunting, and then it turned out, you know, I could take my dad would let me take the vehicle before I even had a license. I had a little tiny pickup, and I started driving around in the bottoms down here, and that was another way to, like, get some freedom, you know, hey, I can take the vehicle if I'm going hunting, you know? So we'd jump in the pickup, me and my buddies, and we'd go hunting, the type of thing that doesn't really happen these days, you know?
Yeah.
Not the type of stuff that you see kids doing anymore, especially at the ages we were.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
But that's all there was to do.
Right. Right. Let me ask you this. I want to back up just a bit. And, you know, you mentioned that your dad only really rifle hunted for a while. Was he, was he passionate about whitetails like 365, or was it just kind of a little bit before gun season and during gun season, and then you pack it up and go? What was his passion level?
He was your standard, just rifle hunter, just everybody, you know, during deer season, it was deer season. You know, he'd always hunted and fished growing up and everything like that, you know, pheasants and all that type of stuff, paddle fishing and fishing and everything like that. But he didn't really get hooked, like, you know, like we are now, you know, where you're out there in the mosquitoes in July, you know, looking for velvet bucks and sitting there and watching and getting eaten alive and planning and hitting the river in spring and shed hunting and, you know, and all that type of stuff. So he kind of was, we kind of fell in love with it around the same time. I would say that we pretty much took on bow hunting and together for the most part. And I think it made a lot more fun when I started going with him too, I'm sure, for him, you know? So I think it was just one of those things where we'd always, you know, I was a big athlete, and, sports, as much as sports brought us together, it also made us fight because I was just so damn stubborn, and he would try to criticize, you know, it was constructive criticism, but I would take it as, you know, it's not like he's telling me, like, I don't know what I'm doing, or I'm not doing it right, or this and that, you know, like typical stubborn kid would.
Yeah.
But bow hunting was one of those things where we were learning together, and it never really resulted in any fighting. It was always just damn good times, laughing, and going, oh, shit, oh, that was crazy, you know, and this and that. And so it was just one of those things where we bonded, where there was no tension between us ever. It was just always like, wow, that worked, and well, like, oh, maybe we should try this, maybe we should try that, and so we kind of learned it together, and, you know, and still to this day, it's about the same thing. Now, it's kind of converted sometimes, now we'll butt heads now, because now it's, you know, we're both so much better than we were back then. Now it's kind of getting back to that we're, you know, that sporting, that, you know, that competitiveness again, where it's like, no, I don't think that's the way, I don't think that's the way we need to go about it. We need to enter and we need to get out of the boat here, and we got to come in here, and we both kind of butt heads here and there about it, but eventually I just basically cave and let him have it his way a lot of the time, just because it's, you know, it's,
you're
dad.
Such a nice son.
Like, all right, well, and then I get to go, I told you, and, you know, when it doesn't go right, right? I told you, they go, oh, whatever, man. You know, and,
so,
like, I know it, and I'll intentionally say, I know if we would have came in from that area, sat in this area, you know, they would have went, I'll bet you a big buck walked right past it.
Right.
You know, like, oh, whatever.
Right. So when your dad, like, got into bow hunting, did you see his passion level, I guess that's what we're calling it, the passion level for whitetails go up? Did he start planning and prepping more because now he was a bow hunter?
Yeah, because, I mean, now it started end of August as opposed to, you know, first week or two of November, you know, and so it was just it was very evident, right? And he'd be going way more than he ever did in the years past, you know, a lot more hunting, and so it was, and then just sitting with him, you know, just watching how things went down, and then his intensity level and excitedness of, you know, you're getting pretty damn serious when something's getting close, like, don't move, you know, like, here it comes, gotta stay low, you know, whatever, you know, and you know how that, you know how somebody will just get that intensity level of when the tensions are starting to run high and then blood starts pumping and everything, like, so that just, like, it just, like, transmitted into me, and you know, we'd both get to be like that, and then I could actually hear better than him, and still to this day I hear way better than him, and because he just ran around in farm equipment and stuff, and on certain jobs he's had throughout his life, his hearing just got diminished, so he doesn't hear very, very well. So having me along, I could hear deer coming long before he could see them. So maybe that's why he brought me.
Just another set of eyes and ears, yeah.
Yeah, I always give a shit about that. It's just like that's one of my favorite things to do anymore now these days when we're sitting together is I go, you hear that? I don't hear a damn thing. You know, he says, and I'm like, no, there's deer coming. And it's hard sometimes. Like, you try to tell somebody that doesn't really hear or, you know, or anything, they don't believe something's coming, and you're trying to tell them, like, get ready. Let's go. There's something coming right through, right over here. It's coming. And then, okay, and then shit, you know, here comes a deer, here comes a coyote or a moose or something. And then he's like, how the hell, that was 5 minutes later after you said you heard something, and something popped out. And I was like, I could hear it, you know, and he's like, ah, geez.
He probably thought you were being a smartass.
That's always one of the funny things. Well, what's that?
He probably thought you're just being a smartass.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, definitely. I can't say I haven't done that in the past, right, playing jokes on them. I mean, Christ, I had to – that was one of the easiest things you could do is, you know, once you have the guy having to believe you, and every now and then you go, oh, God, here comes something big. He's coming. Get ready. And then you watch him get scurried, get ready, and then go, I'm just kidding.
So when as you guys started learning bow hunting together and learning strategy and tactics, and you guys, because you mentioned you started to approach this land as kind of a group, like one of you would sit over here, one of you would sit over there. Were you kind of hunting as a team, or were you still like on an individual level?
Yeah, it was a team. It was definitely a team. It was, you know, and back then there was, I would say there was a pretty fair amount more deer back then. At least that's what it seemed like. It could have been just a lot different pressure too. Back then there wasn't nearly as many bow hunters, so maybe the deer were just more visible. But so we'd hunt, and you know, we'd go hunting. There'd be, you know, a group of deer coming out in this area of the field, and then maybe there'd be a group of deer coming through down here, and we'd kind of just hunt different groups a lot of the time, or if there's a certain area where we'd seen a buck come out in a couple of different spots, we'd just basically split up and try to double the odds, you know?
Right.
So that was the main tactic, you know?
So you guys would almost have a deer located, or, you maybe you saw him from a stand, and now together you guys are like, okay, I'm going to sit here, and if he doesn't come through here, someone needs to sit here, and then he should come out one of these two places.
Right. That was always the game plan. Yep. It was just, and sometimes it was like, well, I don't know where the hell, we don't really have anything really, really great pinned down. So then we just split up, and one would go to this area and get dropped off, and the other would drive down and go to this other area, and basically be doing some scouting for the most part. And then as soon as one of us got something going, it was like, all right, I seen a really good one come out down here. There was a big group of deer come out down here, and one good one and that one. So, you know, if we just split up, maybe we could, one of us can get one of them things.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of how we would go about it.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Real basic, actually.
I want you to tell me a cool story of maybe a time where you guys were still learning together bow hunting. Maybe it was in your teen years, if you can remember that far back, a story about you and your dad hunting as a team on the ground that you guys had. Maybe a lesson or a strategy or a time you bumped head, something that you kind of always remember.
Well, there was a deer. There's always one that kind of comes back to mind. It's not so much, it was kind of a lesson in the way I kind of figured out how a deer used thick, he'd use a thick runway of timber in between the river and a channel of a water channel. And it was a deer we called the Sunday Buck, because it seemed like any Sunday, and it was football Sunday. I remember it all. That's why I kind of remember it so well, is because we, on every Sunday, it was just kind of football, NFL football, and hunting just go hand in hand. It always has been. So it's always been like that for me, is because basically because of this deer. So we'd hunt Sundays in the morning, and then hang out, watch the Vikings game at noon, and then by the time the Vikings game at noon is about over, we could head out and go hunt the evening.
How old were you at this point?
Probably 14.
14, okay.
14-ish, probably. Yep, something like that. And 14, 15. And so there was this deer. We ended up just, the only time we seen it was on a Sunday for some weird reason. I don't know why it happened that way. But it just happened to be that, we'd go sit this area, we'd see that buck, and we'd sit that area any other days, and you just wouldn't see the damn thing. And it just happened to be, I think there was like three times in like that month and a half. It was the only time we seen the deer was on Sunday. And it was strange. And it was an area that we eventually started hunting harder and getting deeper into. But we never did actually kill the deer. But the whole thing about it was the way we bounce back and forth between thinking of where he's going to come out and where he actually came out. He was always using, you could tell he was using the wind and coming off that water in the evening. So he would hug that edge. It was almost like he would hug that edge of the water, so that like anything inside the timber, it was almost like it would almost create, you could see it with the cotton. It was like the cotton would get pulled from the cottonwood trees, and you could see the swirl coming down into the timber off that edge. And I noticed it years later, and that's kind of how I kind of started to figure out, like, maybe that deer was always using that area, because the wind would always do such sporadic things, and we could never really get close to him. And he would, wherever he would pop out, it always seemed to be that would be the best spot for a deer to show up, at that time with that wind direction. It was just always the exact perfect spot for a deer to pop out. And it was like, well, you couldn't even have killed him, especially with this wind and everything that's going on right now, you couldn't have killed him. And we thought there was only a couple of options for him to really come out, but little did we know, at that point, we didn't realize deer would really muck through a bunch of mud and stuff like that. We thought like a little bit of mud and water was going to kind of deter him to stay on this hard ground, but little did we know, that deer would cut through this really swampy, muddy area when the wind was not good for him to use that area close to this water channel. And so it was just one of those things where we just played cat and mouse with this thing for you know, a good 2.5 months, and never could figure him out. I mean, he was a really good deer. It was just nothing major, but it was 150 class, 10, something like that. But we bounced around back and forth on that thing in the mornings, the evenings, and it didn't matter what we did. He always had our number, you know. And after, it was years after when I finally figured out how to hunt that place. And it actually ended up being that come from the river in the morning. And that was the best way to do it, because in the evenings to get there, in the morning to get back there, you come from anywhere driving on roads or from the fields, everything had you pinned before you even got in there. I mean, so that was one of the first areas that we, you know, really started to jump back in there and come from the river. And so it was just one of those things that kind of, it was like almost like a turning point for us, because it would seem like such a simple spot to hunt, but it just showed us so many different things about a deer, you know, the way they use that water, the way they use the, you know, the really swampy, nasty shit, you know, swampy crap that just, you know, you don't think anything would use and try to come through there. And here there was a bunch of deer using that. And you really couldn't see it because it was so soupy mud-like, it didn't leave tracks or anything. It was relatively pretty smart, you know, when you think about it, that, you know, you walk the banks of that stuff and you really couldn't see what was going down into that stuff very well.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And, but the river thing, that's kind of what kind of turned the tides for us, was figuring out that, you know, if we're going to be able to hunt some of these spots in the morning, not just in the evening, and do it correctly, we got to loop around everything and get into the backside. And so that's one thing about that hunt that I guess it really kind of opened my eyes to how smart these damn things are, you know.
Yeah.
It was just kind of funny, and he'd just be visible as hell, but to get to where you could kill him, it was almost impossible, it felt like.
Yeah.
You know, and so, even to this day when I think about the areas that he was coming through and the wind directions, and it'd be tricky. It'd be tricky even know what I know today,
yeah.
You know.
So that particular buck, you guys started putting the pieces of the puzzle together as far as access and really using the river and water as access to backdoor these deer?
Yeah, yeah, yep. And then it actually led us to find out that they were using beaver dams as well to walk across.
Okay.
And so that was once we kind of started figuring out that, you know, this deer, you know, he's doing things that weren't really making sense to us, where he was coming out and he was always a loner. He'd never have any other deer with him. He would always come out alone. There'd be other deer coming out right where we expected him to come out, and every time you were always like, this is the night, you know, he's coming out. And then he'd pop out somewhere just absolutely random, and it seemed so random. And so finally we started, you know, get pressure, you know, put the pressure on, really started to get more aggressive. And I think with just the frustrations of that deer trying to figure it out, it was like, you know, dangling, you know, it was just like dangling candy in front of your face. It was just like, hey, you know, I'm right here. You guys could kill me if you just, you know, figure it out, you know. But so we just kind of, I think we just really got, you know, put the pressure on enough that we started getting back in deeper. We started finding these beaver dams with just massive trails going across them on this little back channel. And then started to figure out, like, you know, these trails run parallel on here. You know, if a guy, you could even sit on the opposite side of this, and the wind could be doing this, and, you know, your wind would be blowing up over here and out off the river. And we started to figure out all these little things that a morning hunt especially would just be prime, you know. And, you know, we'd over the years, that place had gotten just awesome hunting over that next probably 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
And so, now it's actually turned into pretty much nothing. There's pretty much nothing going on there now, because the river has changed so much over the last 10 years that it's pretty much turned it all into backup water and swamp and all that stuff. There's still deer there, but it's just not like it used to be.
Gotcha. So once you started backdooring these deer, was there a big aha moment that led to you having more encounters, maybe being more successful?
Yeah. Yeah. I killed a deer. Pretty sure that one was 2008. I shot a deer with my bow, and It was directly back behind behind all that stuff the old Sunday buck was coming out from. And the hunt I had that morning was just, it was just like one of those hunts. It was the most epic. The first time I heard a buck roar, it was the first time I heard a whole lot of grunting and snort wheezing and fighting and all that. It was just like, it was like I finally figured out how to get into the, you know, the back door and like getting into the bedroom of them deer, like where they were doing everything that they naturally do. It was like I got to see like the behind the scenes for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never seen or heard anything. I always watch all the hunting channels and everything and movies and shows, and you'd see all this stuff going on, and you're like, where the hell are they seeing this, and what are they, you know? And so it always was kind of strange. And that was the first time when I snuck in from the river and set up right on the thick timber line coming right up, running parallel with the river. And the only place that they could, it was just a fantastic pinch, like just pinch down area where it was just thick on both sides. And this area was just constantly shredded with scrapes and rubs and everything like that. And this was the first time I actually snuck in there and hunted in the morning. And I snuck in there, hung my tree stand, set everything up. And I mean, it was first breaking light, and there was deer coming through, and I couldn't see a lot of them. And then finally, I just hear a fight break out in between me and all the in the fields. Hear a fight break out in the willows, whole bunch of deer running all over the place, grunting, snorting, chasing each other. And finally a nice eight comes, big giant bodied eight come plowing through after running off another buck, and he was bumping a doe, and I stuck him at like 15 yards through the heart, and he ran about 20 yards and just went pile head over tail, you know, and just freaking rolled. And it was just like one of those hunts that was like, holy shit, I can't believe that all just happened. You know, like hearing all that stuff and seeing all that stuff for like really the first time, you know, it was like behind the scenes type stuff. It was like, it was this most incredible hunt, you know?
Yeah.
And ever since then, it was like, we kind of, what we had thought was going to be the way to do it ended up being the way to do it. You know,
yeah.
We were kind of getting there. And then finally, you know, kind of set it all up perfect time of the year, got in right where we always knew that somebody had to be. We'd always talk about it. And finally just all come together.
Right. So fast forwarding to today, are you still using a boat for a majority of your access to hunt, or are you guys still like salt and peppering that in with, you know, driving a truck to a parking lot and walking in?
Yeah. It's probably, you know, it's probably about half and half yet.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
You know, about half and half. You know, different times of the year call for a little more boat action than pickup. You know, early season you can get away with not using the boat so much. The deer are kind of just out closer towards food sources and stuff like that. There's not quite pushed as deep yet. You know, getting into October and November and everything's kind of getting pressured. And that's when I'll still use the boat, you know, early season. It's just, it just seems like it's a lot more efficient come October, it feels like.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's you know, we park at a spot, and we just might make a big trek, you know, and make a loop into something, or just, you know, set up closer to areas where people are just overlooking, you know. I mean, everybody, it seems like everybody wants to be the grinder and the guy that, you know, the hunting beast type guy, right? It just goes as deep and as far back as possible and pushes the limits. It seems like there's a lot more of that anymore.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of areas that just get completely overlooked because it's such an easy track into it, and it just doesn't look like much, and that's where a lot of these big bucks are hiding nowadays.
Yeah.
We're finding.
Yeah. That's funny you say that, because I was out with my kids the other day, and we had just come back from kind of like an easy mushroom hunt, and I wanted to show, there was this time of year is when the carp start to spawn, and they were coming up into this backwater and they're jumping out of the water and all these things. And I wanted to show my kids just like these big fish jumping out of the water. And I'm looking down on the ground and I cut this gigantic track, and I just had to like put it in the bank and, come back to it. So I don't know if it's going to be tomorrow or this week sometime. I'm going to head back in and follow where I think this track was going, right? What directions, and try to find some bedding or whatnot. But it's on a giant piece of public, and it's not too far where this track was at. And granted, right, a lot can happen from now until October. But at least there's the deer in the area right now. And it's it got me kind of excited because it was a huge track and it wasn't very far from the parking lot.
Yeah, most definitely. Now, like in your area, is it kind of like this? Because over here, I could find, just the other day I was just on the corner of my property down here in this alfalfa field and giant buck track, you know. And so right away, I'm like, oh, yeah, I kind of feel like I know where he's coming from, where he's living. But, you know, that track, that could be from a deer that lives a mile or two or, you know, away from here, you know, come hunting season. You know, very, very likely, actually. So I don't know, is that something that you notice down there, too, that sometimes you kind of get an eye on something, or you kind of get a feeling that, there's a big deer that's running around and all of a sudden he just kind of disappears at certain times of the year?
Well, I mean, that's exactly how my farm is, my main farm. Now, it's not a river bottom farm like where I was at the other day, right? You hunt big tracks of river bottom, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I was scouting in a big track of river bottom. But as far as what you're saying, deer disappearing, man, if the farm that I hunt, if all the bucks from the summer stuck around, man, I would have the best farm in Iowa. I feel like, dude, velvet picture, the, you know, like giant booners on camera all the time. And then September hits, the velvet comes off and there's the huge shift and they go away. Right.
Yeah.
So, but as far as, you know, and I mean, just a little bit longer than that, I've had deer stick around for, you know, 2 years, disappear for a couple years and then come back and then go away again. Right. So, it's just, I don't know. There's consistency, but then there's some deer who their patterns just, I don't know, are wonky.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, actually, because, yeah, I've seen the same thing. I've seen the same thing where we'll lose track of deer, you know, that maybe have been around for a couple of years, and they haven't really gone anywhere, and all of a sudden we'll lose track. Well, they got shot, and then pretty quick he shows up on a trail camera or something, or we see him, and it's like, what the hell? You know, where'd he come from? Where's he been? You know, and it's crazy. It's crazy, man. There's a private section right next to my house here and that I'll hunt from time to time just because it's fun to hunt because there's a lot of deer there, you know. So you go out there and you just, it's all more of just a relaxing, just sit back and watch all the action for the most part. And there's across the highway, there's another private section. And it's funny how often even he, the landowner over there, loses track of bucks and they don't even end up over here. You know, so we'll both be talking about maybe even the same particular bucks or a buck or something, and we'll go, oh, where the hell did that deer go? You know, I don't know. You know, it's kind of funny how they'll just disappear, and then all of a sudden they'll show right back up randomly.
Yeah.
It's like, I wonder what that is.
Is there a lot of ag in your river bottoms?
Yeah, lots of alfalfa and sugar beets and corn and,
Do they rotate crops like they do in Iowa?
Yep.
So, does that play a role? Because I know that there are that, in my opinion, not necessarily as far as the area, the general area, but on the farm, the farm itself, crop rotation plays a huge role in where the deer move on the farm.
Yeah, most definitely does. The sugar beets, like, it's a late season thing. So it's like, it's one of the things you just pay attention to, you know, going into late season, you always know where all the sugar beet fields are, because those will probably be loaded, you know. That's going to, a lot of the deer, it's where I'd pick up a lot of my sheds in springtime, you know, and coming into spring, you know, end of winter there. That's where you'd pick up a lot of sheds, a lot of them, all them sugar beet fields. Now, you know, early season, they'll hit those, but it seems like they're just kind of like, it's almost like they won't stay in them long. They'll just kind of go up there, get a little bite to eat, and then they're on to the next field, probably alfalfa or something like that. And then, you know, on the way back in the morning, you know, they'll grab a quick snack of some sugar beets, you know, and then they're off and back, and, you know, but they won't spend a whole lot of time in them. That is definitely something I've noticed. Yeah, I've noticed that plays a role. Like I said, especially the late season, it seems like, you know, where we'll get deer even crossing the river, you know, to come over to a bunch of sugar beets in late season, you know.
Has there ever been a time where, how far is the private that has the ag on it away from the public that you spend most of your time on? Is it right next to each other, or is it like a road and a property away?
Well, so the little private section that is right by my house, that's basically all private. And then it's basically right across the river is some public.
Okay.
So literally it's a big private timber spot, and then it's got private fields and everything up top. And then across the river is the public, and so it's all pretty well separated,
are the deer then, do the deer kind of stay in the bottoms? Is the egg up out of the bottoms, or is it down in the bottoms?
So it's in the bottoms. There's kind of like the old river channel is basically what it is. There's an old river channel here that it drops down like 10 to 15 feet off of the fields, and it drops down, and that's just in this area. You know, there's a lot of this along the river bottom where there's an old river channel that isn't there. There's not river there anymore, but so it just turned into a bunch of timber down below. And so you'll have all the fields that are up about that 10, 15, 20 foot, you know, embankment, and then you got all the fields, and so all the deer drop down into the timber most in a lot of areas.
Right.
And then all that butts up to the river further back.
Okay.
Away from those fields. Yep.
Okay. So I know that in the past you guys have, you know, especially recent years, you guys have been dealing with a lot of flooding. What are the deer doing when it starts to flood?
Oh yeah, they're piled up in high ground areas. They'll head for the hills, you know.
And most of that's private, right?
Yeah, a lot of the hill country around here is private. Yeah, on each side of the valley. There's some public, but much more private than public down along the river. Yep. That was basically how I killed my deer last year. You know, the flooding kind of just it made it just almost. I mean, he was living literally on a little strip of land that was up off the water, you know.
Yeah.
And based off of everything I knew about that deer at that time, that water just made it that much more easy to kill him, you know. It eliminated so much ground that I knew I would have to cover, you know. And I knew it all just kind of came together. After I missed him, I missed my shot at that deer the year before. When he went running off, I mean, all I could go through my head is, if he survives till the following fall, I'm going to kill him, because I knew at that point exactly every little thing about him that I could learn about a deer. I knew it, and I knew where his home, I knew where his core area was, and he seemed to be a very, very core-driven deer, where he was just, that was his area.
Yeah.
And it was hard. It was super hard to get in and kill him. I mean, that's why he grew up to be what he was. And it was just was super tough. You had to be super careful, and you had to take just take a big risk to go in there and kill him. You know.
So when the water level then came up, it just made it that it just eliminated certain places where you thought he was going to be, and it was just like a no brainer. You're like, dude, I know so much about this deer. Now with the high water, I know exactly where he's at.
Right. Yep. Okay. Exactly. I mean, because I knew with the way the water level was, I knew that area that he was living in, that particular area he liked to be and where he kind of seemed to be, where his core bedding area was, I knew that was dry.
Yeah.
And with the way he was being like extremely less visible in the summertime, and towards the end of summer, I just knew that if he was alive, that's where he was, and if I slipped in there at the right time, I knew he was going to be in there. You know, I just knew it.
Okay.
And got in there, all the signs started to show up right as I got into that little strip. It was basically a little strip of timber, probably 60 yards wide.
Yeah.
And it ran, you know, a few hundred yards long. And I knew he's going to be bedded up at that north tip of it. He's going to be bedded right up in there where he always was, where I've seen him coming in and out of there over the last year and a half. And so I just gambled. It was the first time I went after him. And if it wasn't for that water, you know, I wouldn't have probably went that aggressive on it. And especially knowing everything I knew about him, but with the water being the way it was, and I just had a feeling, that gut feeling, and went for it. And sure enough, I watched him get up out of his bed, you know.
Yeah.
One of the coolest things I've ever seen in my life, you know.
Yeah. If you guys want to hear the whole story on that buck, you need to go to the Sportsman's Nation website and just type in Lucas, and that podcast will pop up. It's a pretty kick-ass story, so I highly recommend going and listening to that episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles. But I have one more question about the river and how that plays a role, because this year I obviously am going to be hunting my main farm, but when I am home, I'm going to be doing a little bit more public land, river bottom hunt myself, and it always floods throughout the summer. From your experience, when there's a flood and it kicks the deer out of the bottoms, how long does it typically take them, once the water recedes, to funnel back into the area and kind of go back to business as usual?
Around here, it's super quick. It's super quick. And actually, I've gone into some timber that, I mean, basically drained in the last few days, and there'd be already, like immediately, there'd be fresh tracks back there, you know. And I'm sure that's because there's maybe a few deer still living around there. But I think my favorite thing about living on the river and when it floods is it leaves all these low-lying areas, like little runways or, you know, waterways or bayous, whatever you want to call them. It leaves a really, here the mud leaves really good tracks.
Yeah.
In some of these runways and these bayous. So what I love about those is I'll walk those. I'll get off at the river, and take my boat, and I'll get off, and I'll walk these. I got all these kind of just already mapped out in my head. I know where all the ones I like to hit and all that stuff. So, I mean, usually about 2 weeks, probably, those will start to show a lot of sign, you know, of deer crossing them. And then over about a 3 to 4 week period, it seems to be where you can actually see the really, you know, distinguished areas where deer are really traveling,
right.
You know, and leaving all that the tracks. I mean, the tracks just tell the story, especially for that early season hunting. That's one of my favorite things about working off the river is, you know, and when that flood comes up, it just makes everything so, I mean, it just dampens everything, and it leaves, you know, a lot of times bare ground, so deer can't, their tracks can't be hidden, and so it don't take long. It's, you know, up here anyways, you know, as soon as that stuff starts to dry up, them deer, they're heading back to where they like to be and where they're comfortable, it seems like.
Right.
You know, it don't take long at all.
So that's where the cover is, right? Because up in the hills, it's more barren ground.
Yeah, yeah, and you'll see deer hanging out in little small clumps of timber just up out of the main river bottom that are you know, just up here in the fields, you know. There's going to be some clumps of timber that, you know, are still standing. There's, you know, some little chunks here and there, and you'll see deer just bedding in that type of stuff. And they're not really in any kind of great timber, but I mean, that time of the year, they're not being pressured. So, you know, during the summer, I've started in the last few years catching on to how I can really glass these particular spots that you would never even think that there'd be deer there, but because there's flood, there's deer, you know? And they're just coming out of little tiny pockets of timber. I mean, it could be just a big, thick, grassy ditch or something, basically. And then pretty quick, there's, you know, seven deer standing outside of that little patch, you know, at last light. And a lot of times you can get your eyes on some mega bucks at that time of the year around here.
What?
Just doing that.
Have you had better success in wet years or dry years?
Wet.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's because when the water's high, it makes them more predictable?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yep.
Gotcha.
And now, you know, I usually hunted a lot of dry, you know, dry river bottoms for a lot of years. And now that this river's changed, you know, so much that now it floods so much that I've started to figure out how deer like to use all that stuff to their advantage. And I'm starting to figure out where all these little spots are that they'll hole up in, because that's maybe some dry ground, or it's maybe the easiest path of travel. You know, maybe it gets the driest the fastest, or, you know, or they just go, there's nothing that can get me if I go out to this little spot. You know, there's water around every side, and that's where that big one will go run and hide, you know. And I'm looking forward to this year, because we kind of stumbled across a spot now this last 2 years where we've jumped a big buck out of this little point that's like, it's basically a little finger that comes off of a large piece of timber, and it's a little finger that's got a basically an old waterway on each side of it, and it's not really that great of a looking spot, but we've kicked a giant buck out of there 2 years in a row now, and the only way to hunt it is going to be a canoe. You have to use a canoe or a kayak. You're going to have to slip back in there, and it's surrounded by water all except for one side, and so it's just a finger. And we're looking forward to trying that spot out and ambushing a big deer on that, because it seems like it was the same buck as well. It's the same damn buck. So, and it's an old deer. So we're figuring if he's still around, he'll be there. If not, there's another buck to take that spot, guaranteed.
Yeah.
It's just too good. So
it is almost June. When do trail cameras get deployed for you?
Well, I haven't hardly even used any in the last couple years in the summertime for the most part. I mean, not necessarily like I'd used to. My dad kind of took up the trail camera stuff. He's kind of been having fun with that. So I kind of get him geared up anymore. And he gets out there and puts a bunch of cameras out, and I'll help him a little bit. But I suppose we'll probably start doing that towards the end of June, probably.
Okay.
Middle to the end of June, you know, just to start getting a look at maybe some sort of a frame growing on the deer. Depending on how high the water is, too, at that point. It doesn't look like we're going to have a whole lot of a high water year this year, it doesn't look like. So it could be a little different. A little more widespread, not as easy to get eyes on something this summer.
Yeah.
But
cool, man. Cool. But,
yeah.
Now, last time I talked to you, you were getting geeked out about moose.
Yeah.
Did your wife draw a moose tag last year?
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I was just going to get into. My mind's not even on deer right now.
Yeah.
My whole focus this year is all moose in my head. It's all moose. I'm going to do everything possible to help my wife be in the right spot to take out a moose.
Yeah.
And so that I think that's, I haven't even looked at the start date, I guess, on that, I guess, yet. So I'm going to be doing a hell of a lot of scouting for moose this year.
That's crazy. I heard that South Dakota, and you live up there, so correct me if I'm wrong, they've seen some absolute giant moose, like, that start to rival what's up north.
Yo, even South Dakota?
No.
Or you mean North Dakota? Okay.
North Dakota.
Yeah.
Like, north of you, meaning like Canada and Alaska.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we like I said, there was a, A record with Bo was just shot this past year, just not far from here, in the river bottom. And there's been a moose that he's still alive as far as we know. He would freaking be an absolute monster if somebody's able to catch up with him. There's getting to be some damn good ones running around this river bottom, definitely. Yeah. Really good one.
What's the moose population like? Like, what's a good moose population in the area?
Oh gosh, the past years, I don't even know what the numbers. I think they were counting like 80 or 90 moose. I would probably put this at a 12 mile long river bottom here.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 3-4 miles wide. But there's piles of these things down here, and it's not just here either. All over the state of North Dakota, people are smacking these things, yeah. You know, and they're getting. I mean, north of here, and then east, northeast of here, east of here is just there's just becoming more and more and more, and you know, this river bottom, I think, is just kind of taken to taken to this river bottom so well is because of those, especially with this water level, the way it's been the past. You know, 5 to 10 years being so high, and it's creating these really marshy, really just high water type areas where these moose just thrive.
Yeah.
You know, the willows, they have everything they need to eat. They have no predators. You know, they're just growing and just multiplying like crazy. And so it's becoming one of those spots, I think, over the next, you know, the next few years and I think into the future, if this the way it continues the way it's going. We don't have anything weird with diseases or anything come out. This is going to be a well sought out tag, you know, for people trying to get, and it is around here already for just the residents.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's. I mean, the shed season here is absolutely bonkers. I mean, any more, it's good luck shed hunting.
Yeah.
Good luck. You know, because yeah. I mean, there's people that are driving these roads at first light every damn morning through shed season. Because
the moose
are still out in the field, and they'll get out, and then they're easy to spot, you know, in the snow. So all they have to do is get eyes on them, and they see everything's carrying their antlers still, and then they're out of there. They see something that, you know, these groups are, oh, there's a couple bulls with, you know, a missing antler or two. Now they're glassing fields for the next couple hours, probably,
yeah.
You know, and then they're going to get out and go trek. So... it's gotten wild. There's probably more shed hunters than there are regular hunters around here anymore.
What's the tag allocation for a resident?
Here.
Is it lottery or is it
preference
point?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lottery and it's a once in a lifetime tag. I forget the number they gave out this year. It's a once in a lifetime tag, so you draw it, you get either or. Right? You can put in for a cow moose, but most people are just going to put in for the either or. And so once you draw it, you're done. Even if you don't kill, it doesn't matter. You're done. You don't never get that tag again. But it's a tough one. It's not something I think some of us are going to never draw it, probably.
Yeah.
Especially it's getting more and more popular every year. So, you know, for my wife to draw it, it's absolutely insane. You know, yeah. she actually drew it, but
what are the draw odds? Do you know?
Really shitty.
<Yeah. laughs>
That's all I can tell you. I mean, I really couldn't tell you. I'm just that, you know, I've never been the guy to look into that stuff really that much. I just never have. I just never have, man.
Yeah.
I'd rather just, you know, if I want something, I'll put in for it. And, you know, especially here, right? It's his home, so I just never put in for it. It's like that doesn't really matter, right? I mean, I'm gonna put in for it regardless, you know. So whatever the odds are, it doesn't matter in my head, I guess. But
you're just gonna try.
Just gonna try, man. Yeah. I mean, it's like there's no reason not to, you know. There's no reason to put in really for any other units because this is the only one I want to kill one in. So. It's just like, oh, we just put in, you know, hope and pray we draw one. And she drew one and there's a damn good spot on the wall for that big old Euro that she's gonna have up there. It's ever since we moved into this house a couple years ago, I was like, There's going to be a big Giro moose on that wall at some point.
Right. Right.
I just think them things look awesome.
Yeah. Man, the moose is definitely on my bucket list for sure, man. I think I've talked about it before, but I want to do like a Yukon River float trip where they say, here's all the stuff you need, float down the river, set up camp, you know, go in, hunt them, you know, float down the river and say, hey, you need to be here by this date. What you do between now and then is up to you. Don't get eaten by a grizzly bear. Like that kind of
hunt. And now is that something that you can do without a guide is on the Yukon, or isn't it?
I would probably need a guide in Canada, but in Alaska, I think they just drop you off.
Well, no, I think Canada might be, it might be opposite, because I think Alaska is where you got to have somebody.
I don't know.
If I remember correctly. My cousin lives up there, and I remember him telling me about that because he's got the whole setup. He's got the fan boat. He's got everything. So my cousin, it's her fiance, and they go up and they live up there in Wasilla, Alaska. And it's just incredible, man. He sends me these videos every year on his phone.
Yeah.
Holy shit, that hunt looks phenomenal.
Yeah.
And he's told me, he's like, we're doing it at some point. You're coming up here and we're going to do it. So I'm like you, man. That's my big time bucket list hunt right there.
Yeah. You know,
definitely.
I think guys like us were born to live in Alaska because I heard that, okay, so they don't have whitetails in Alaska, right?
Yes.
But there's 54 different tags that a guy can take advantage of.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Like I said,
it's freaking phenomenal, man.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, that shoreline bear hunting that we did up there while I was up there with those guys off the coast of the ocean and the Prince William Sound. Holy hell, was that awesome. That was something. That was not like your typical bear hunting, right? Like you're sitting over a big bait pile and you're just smacking something.
Right.
You know, which I don't have any problem with that, with anybody doing it. It's just not something that excites me to go do.
Yeah.
You know, but that type of hunting where you're out on the water, you're in your bigger boat and you spot these things and you toss the little dinghy boat out that's barely big enough for two guys and you throw three, four guys in the damn thing and you're heading off to the shore there and you're trying to cut them off and get close. And we've stocked up to really close to some of these bears, and you know they had rifles, my cousins and them. So then we killed one bear up there while I was there. Me and Jen were up there, but that right there, man, with a bow, I don't know if a guy goes up there in that scenery and you're out there doing with that, you know you're catching halibut, you're shrimping, you can go kill a bear. Holy hell!
Yeah,
you know, I'll take that all day.
Absolutely, man.
You know? It ain't like you can't always come back and do the deer hunting, right?
Yeah.
You could always make a trip back to, you know, the Midwest and go shoot some deer, you know, and hunt some deer, because it's not something you're going to forget, you know, and how to do. And it's probably not something that, you know, you and I, we probably got to practice really a whole lot at doing. You know, you kind of just got it down now. You know how to get out there and put yourself in a decent situation at least, you know. So I'm getting to that point, man. I've killed, I think, you know, my fair share of whitetails over the years, and you know, I wouldn't be opposed to moving to Alaska or something like that. That place is incredible.
Right. Well, I think we got another topic for another podcast coming up pretty soon, huh?
Yes, sir.
Well, I tell you what, man, I really appreciate your time, Lucas. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day to hop on and chat with me. And good luck this upcoming season, man.
Right on, man. It's always a pleasure. Take care. Say hi to the family, you know, and, you know, anytime, give me a shout. I'll jump on. It's always fun bullshitting.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Another Hump Day episode in the books. Big shout out to Lucas. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with me a little bit. Huge shout out to you, the listener. Thank you very much. I hope all you guys get the opportunity in your life at some point to eat baby carrots and drink Budweiser. And lastly, huge shout out to the partners of this podcast. They make it all possible. Ozonics, scent elimination, wasp broadheads, lone wolf portable tree stands, the average conservationist, and of course, our title sponsor, Vortex Optics, man. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast. Please go to iTunes or wherever you download this podcast and subscribe. And I tell you what, man, after that, have a good day. Have a good life. Call somebody that you haven't talked to in a while and chit-chat with them. Go outside, enjoy Mother Nature and the fresh air, and I will talk to you next time.